Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to the Revolution Watch podcast.
Yes, this is episode 2. And so far we've gotten great feedback from the first one. And so we'll use that advice to keep improving on future ones. Mm-hmm. And so I'm Kevin, your host, digital editor at Revolution Hong Kong. And I'm here with Steph.
Hi, I'm Stephanie, managing editor at Revolution Hong Kong.
And later on, we will have two guests, which are also editors at the Revolution in other regions.
Yeah, we have Keith Strandberg, who is the US editor-in-chief, and Sumit Nag, who is the global online editor.
First of all, I'm happy to say that our podcast is now available in all major platforms. So Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, Stitcher, and you know, more. So go subscribe if you haven't, and share the podcast with your friends who I'm sure will appreciate another watch podcast.
Mm-hmm. And one more thing. So apart from the main revolution.watch website that everyone knows, we've also recently launched the Hong Kong specific version of it, which is revolution.watch/Hong Kong. And so if you live in the city or, you know, are interested in the Hong Kong market, you'll be able to find stories relating more to Hong Kong and what's happening in the city on that website.
There's also two videos that were published recently on the website, which are interviews made by our founder, Wei Ko. First video he made with his good friend, Ahmed Rahman, who's also known as Time Mechanic on Instagram. And the other one is with Yoni Ben Yehuda from Material Good in New York City. So go check it out. Yeah. All right, so that was the housekeeping kind of section of the episode. So a lot has happened in the past month since we recorded the first episode. So we have to talk, obviously, about, you know, SIHH and the watches that were shown during the January fair. So this episode is going to be SIHH heavy, but there's a lot we need to get through. So I wasn't actually at SIHH this year, but Steph was. And so Steph, can you tell us a little bit how, you know, the fair was, the atmosphere of the fair?
Sure, of course. So it's only my second year at SIHH. So for me, everything is still really exciting. I love that you're able to, I think when you see all the novelties in one place, you get a much clearer picture of what's happening in the industry. And because you're meeting so many different people, it's a great place to network. The general consensus is that this year it's the watches that are offered are all pretty amazing. Also, the FHH has done so much more to make it a really fun experience for everyone who's at the fair. There are so many different talks with people. Obviously, you get a lot of celebrities there, like Michael B. Jordan was with Piaget, and there, and who else? Pierce Brosnan was there as well, and JLC always has. I mean, JLC brought a lot. Like, they brought Amanda Seyfried was there.
Oh, she was?
She was there, oh, yeah, with
okay.
JLC.
I didn't see that picture.
So that was pretty cool. Who else? Your favorite actor from Mont Blanc?
Oh,
Hugh Jackman.
Oh, Hugh Jackman, yeah. Wolverine.
Wolverine.
Yeah, he's always there. Yeah, he loves being going
but
to
I
the
think,
fair.
I think it's really amazing what he does for Mont Blanc because, I mean, he's not just another face at the fair. He actually hosted an entire conference and spoke to David Cerato and CEO Nicholas Beretsky. So that was a pretty cool.
Yeah, he's one of those guys where, you know, he actually likes the brand that he represents. And I think he just tries to show it as much as possible. I mean, you feel like it's very genuine when you see him speak or just like, you know, walk around promoting the watches.
And I think, I mean, I don't know for sure, but for me, like the last year and this year, the booths has been amazing as well. They're not just, you know, a storefront. They do have a lot of themes that go on. Jaeger LeCoultre, for example, they brought real trees into the booth to make it look like the Vallée des Jeux.
Ooh, that's cool.
Which is really cool. IWC brought a real Spitfire into.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I was gonna ask. So, like, how big is the plane in real life?
You're asking me how big a plane? It's a.
Well, because like, you have to imagine, right? So like, it's a proper plane, right? Mm-hmm. So like, how much space did they need to actually fit like a real plane in it?
Oh, it took up.
And then they also had like a bar at the same time, is it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the space that they had was pretty big, but they fill it. The bar was smaller than last year, I think. So maybe. That's where Space went.
I mean, IWC always makes a good job with their booths.
Yeah, and Piaget, last year they had a pool theme. This year they had a more sandy beach vibe scene.
With like proper sand.
Yeah, with proper sand.
Damn, that's cool.
And a proper bar serving champagne all day long.
It was like for people to chill, like in between appointments.
But I mean, like we're all working there. I make it sound really exciting and really fun, but for a lot of us journalists, it's presentation after presentation after presentation. So real work is being done at the fair.
And so from the booths, do you have one favorite that stood out?
For me, the booths?
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the Piaget one just because, I mean, you're in Geneva in winter. It's cold and dark outside.
Yeah.
And so being in Piaget, it's kind of like, oh, you're on a beach holiday almost. So I really enjoyed that one.
Right. And then from the watches, is there one that stood out to you?
For me, if you're talking about in terms of like me actually seeing myself wearing any of the watches, as a lady, I feel like I can appreciate a lot of the technical achievements in watches like the ones we see from Vacheron, from the ones we see at like JLC or even Beauvais, but I don't necessarily see myself being able to carry off those pieces, right? So for myself, I love the more simple watches that have a really good design that instantly jumps out at you. So for me, like Cartier has done a really good job. I mean, they've always done a really good job, but this year's offering was spectacular. I really liked the... everyone talks about the Santos Dumont, which I also really love, but I really like the Bagnoir and the small, the vintage one that they've brought back. What are you looking at?
I don't know the name of that small one.
Oh, it's just the Bagnoir.
Oh, is it the Bagnoir? Oh, sorry, okay.
But it's just the small version, the most simple one that's like directly the most original version of it. I guess I also really like the Laurent Ferrier Bridge one. That's also simple time only, but they've done it in the square case that everyone says it's like, oh, they did it with Ervoirk for the Arpole one.
Yeah. It's kind of similar shape that the one they did Ervoirk for, was it Only Watch, I believe? And then so they did one with Only Watch, and then after they released like a proper one.
So I really like that one. I actually went to the Patek Philippe Museum in Geneva as well, and they had, like, Patek Philippe has one watch that looked really, like, you can tell the Laurent Ferrier Bridge one was inspired by that one,
right.
That watch. And I mean, Laurent Ferrier worked at Patek Philippe for years, so...
We all know that connection, so I guess he took inspiration.
But anyway, I feel like it doesn't really matter that, Kevin, you didn't go to the fair, because we have so many videos on Revolution's website that that our video team put together that actually give you a very first-hand look at the collection. So you almost feel like you're in the same room with Wei, looking at the collection for the first time. You see his immediate reaction. Like even if you're not in Geneva, you can feel like you are with us.
Yeah, for sure. So it's good to have that first like impression, and then you go and do your own research and kind of look at the in-depth articles later.
Yeah, so I guess like for online, we have the overview, the very raw, unedited take on what we've seen at SIHH. And then in the magazine,
it's a more detailed version of it. It's a more comprehensive, longer.
So our magazine comes out in March, and in it, obviously, we have gathered all our editors' take on the fair and their reviews on the different watches. And so for this episode, we thought we'd bring in some of our editors from overseas to talk about their impressions and some of the watches that they've covered. Shall we introduce our guests?
Yeah, so first guest is Keith Strandberg, who is the editor-in-chief of Revolution USA. And we're gonna jump on a call with him right now. Let's go. All right, so joining us on the line is Keith Strandberg, editor-in-chief of Revolution USA. What's up, Keith?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. So before we get into the whole SIHH conversation, we would like to talk a little bit about you and learn a bit more about how you got into watches and how long you've been working at Revolution.
Okay. Well, I've been in watches for more than 30 years. I kind of fell into watches, writing about watches. I was a regular journalist, you know, covering a lot of different things. My major in college actually was Chinese language and literature and physical education with a minor in Oriental philosophy.
Cool.
And I got into action filmmaking. I was a writer and producer of action films. And in between, when I'd finish a film, I would always buy what I thought at the time was a nice watch as a sort of reward for finishing a movie. And in between the movies, I needed to do something. So I was working as a journalist. And so I wrote for a number of different titles, mostly industry magazines. And I got more and more qualifications and more credits, I was able to start writing about things that I liked. And motorcycling was one of the things I started writing about, China travel, and also watches. And I quickly learned that the watches that I was buying after each movie were not so good. And my first job in the watch industry was working for a trade paper called National Jeweler, which was based in New York. Yeah, National Jeweler is still around. It's only it's a website now, a website and a blog. It doesn't print anymore. But back then, it was published every 2 weeks, so the deadlines were really tight and hard, and it was a great introduction to the watch industry and a great introduction into that sort of very demanding journalism.
That's really cool. Do you speak any Chinese?
I do. I speak Chinese.
Oh, that's really cool.
你们也会讲中文吗？我会,
但是 Kevin 不会.
我们就讲 Kevin 的坏话,好不好?
On the podcast. Yeah.
I've been at Revolution for a little over 3 years now, and I'm really having the time of my life because Revolution is such a creative place, and we can do so many really cool things. So I'm having a really good time.
Yeah, well, we've seen you've even be able to kind of include a bit of your martial art background into it.
Yes, that's the nice thing. I can set up trips. Like I went to the Shaolin Temple. And, you know, we did a motorcycle ride through China. And so it's a great way to take some of the things that I love and combine watches with them, which I think is important because Revolution is really about the lifestyle of watches from my perspective. Not so much, I'm not that technical guy. I'm more of a lifestyle, a story guy than I am a technical person.
That's great. And so over your whole career, how did you see the kind of like print media evolve over the years?
Well, at the beginning, when I first started in it, it was very, very trade oriented. It was very industry, specifically because I was writing for a trade paper, but even the consumer stuff was very sort of trade, technical specification oriented. It wasn't so much about lifestyle, but then when Revolution was introduced, it really changed the game. It became something that was exciting and interesting, which was, not to be cliche, a little bit revolutionary at the time. I think a lot of people have followed that. And so in general, I think watch journalism now is a lot more lifestyle than it ever was. And that's, I think, due to Revolution.
So how many SIHH fairs have you attended?
I think I've attended all of them, actually. I'm not sure what year it is this year, but I think it's in the 20s. So I think I've been to every one. Wow. I remember when they were together, like they're going back to being together next year.
Yeah. Do you think it'll be a better structure?
No, I don't. I think that it's going to be hard. I think, we start with SIHH. I think we start with 3 days of SIHH. Then there's a travel day. Then it's 5 days of Basel. And I think it's going to be hard. I think it'll be hard to keep the enthusiasm over the course of that time. One of the nice things about the way it used to be is that I believe that Basel was first and SIHH was after. At least that's my recollection of it. And SIHH at that time was a really enjoyable fair because there were only 16 brands. And so you went from the hustle and bustle of Basel to a very calm fair where you had an hour and a half with every brand. You had time between appointments. And now SIHH has changed dramatically. There are 30 plus brands. And it's quite a bit like Basel, but with almost less time, because you know, I'm really only at SIHH for 3 days, so trying to see everybody, it's a real stress now.
I feel like even on the very last day of SIHH, everyone's so fatigued and tired from I think just being indoors the entire time.
Right, and then we're gonna have to travel to Basel and do 5 more days of being in that all the time.
Exactly.
So that's gonna be a challenge. It's you know, we all love watches, and so I'm still really excited about seeing the watches at every fair, but to keep that level of enthusiasm up is going to be a challenge. I'm sure we'll be able to do it, and we'll, you know, the nice thing about this SIHH and what I'm thinking will happen in Basel is that the brands are really coming up with interesting and innovative products. So, you know, we went through a time where there were a lot of Me Too kind of watches, and I think that time is over, which is great, and makes it easier for us to go into meetings knowing that we're going to see something that's cool.
Okay. So what was your general feeling of SIHH this year?
I thought that SIHH in general, every brand had something interesting to propose. I don't remember a meeting walking in and thinking, oh, they're just showing me the same stuff that I've seen before. Everybody had at least one hero product, and in many cases, they had more than one hero product. So I thought it was really spectacular.
And do you think there was any specific trend that came up this year, or not really?
I don't think there was a trend other than really great product at what I thought were reasonable prices. I think we get a little jaded when we say reasonable prices, because often we'll see a spectacular high complication and they'll tell us the price and we'll nod and go, oh, that's a nice price, when it's something we could never afford. But you know, in many cases, there were watches that the entry price to get into a brand like Jaeger LeCoultre or IWC was really quite reasonable.
Yeah, and then at the same time, if you look at JLC, they're still able to provide, let's say, good value in some of their entry level watches. But at the same time, they still produce very high end, complicated pieces that shows their power and complexity.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, you look at the Gyro Tourbillon 5.
Yeah.
You know, and then they bring out a really cool colored reverso. It's all, you know, it shows the breadth of their ability to make every sort of watch, honestly.
So did you have any favorites, or did you see any specific brand that kind of stood out and did something very special this year?
Well, I was really impressed with Cartier this year. I thought they brought out a lot of different really cool timepieces. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Beauvais, and it was just Beauvais' first SIHH, and I thought the watches that use that writing desk-style sapphire case were really beautiful. I thought JLC, as we just talked about, brought out some great pieces. I was really impressed with everybody. You know, even Baume & Mercier with their Baumatic perpetual calendar, it was something I was surprised to see, and it was a welcome addition to their line, I think. And that Vacheron Constantin piece, the twin
beat.
Yes, the one that, you know, because I've always been advocating for longer power reserves. I think it's ridiculous that we have 48-hour power reserves today.
Yeah.
When people are trading their watches, you know, they wear the watch for a day or two and then they put on another one and they go back to a watch with 48 hours and the power reserve is depleted and it's stopped. You know, especially with a perpetual calendar or a more complicated piece, you need to have longer power reserves today. And to have something like that twin beat was really amazing with this. I think it was 70-hour power reserve in regular function and 65 days power reserve if you put it into sort of sleep mode. I mean, that was really a stunning development.
Yeah, for sure.
And do you think we'll see more of this type of watches in the future, which allow for a longer power reserve?
I think we have to. Panerai sort of started it when they started introducing 3-day power reserves in their sports watch lines, which was really unheard of. And then a couple of years ago, I think it was Van Cleef and Parmigiani, excuse me, that introduced a watch they were hoping would reach 100 days, was it? I'm trying to remember what it was an amazing length of power reserve. They weren't able to achieve it yet. They're still working on it, I think. But I think if a watch brand is smart, they're looking at developing longer power reserves.
Yeah, and I mean, especially since, you know, people chase this high-end complication, the perpetual calendar, it would make sense to have a watch that is able to, you know, still work for a long period of time so that you don't have to reset everything whenever you pick up the watch again.
Yeah, some of those watches are very complicated to reset. Imagine if you have a, you know, a time and tide watch that you have to go to these charts and figure out how to set it. Yeah. You know, the last thing you want to do is set it again. Sure, we can all buy winders, but I think the smart thing is to develop longer power reserves.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Okay, I think we can't really talk about SIHH without touching on some of the controversies, some of the biggest stories that came out of it. And I think one of them was the feedback that Audemars Piguet got for the release of the code 1159. I think it was quite telling of the times because on social media, they made such a great deal of it. And when it actually came out, obviously, it was not what people expected and stuff like that. So I don't know. What is your opinion of the entire you know, launch of the watch? And yeah, what do you think of the watch in general?
Well, I think the controversy has been kind of amusing to watch from an outsider mm-hmm. standpoint. A lot of times I'm in a meeting with a company like Audemars Piguet or another company, and they'll ask me what I think about a watch, and they'll ask me what my opinion of the design is. And honestly, I never answer because I don't know. I'm a journalist. I'm covering these watches. I'm not a watch designer. So I'll sit there in a meeting and another journalist will start critiquing it or saying they should have done this or that. I'm looking at him like, are you kidding me? You know nothing. Why would you talk to this guy who's spent all his life designing watches and go, I think the second hand is a little too long. You know, I just want to slap those people. Now, I think the feedback from the end consumer is much more valuable because they're the consumers. They're the ones that are going to buy this watch. Whether they like it or not, I think that's valuable. But from a journalism standpoint, I think whatever anybody says as a journalist is completely worthless. And I think this controversy is overblown. You know, there have been a lot of watches that have come out, including the Royal Oak, that were criticized heavily when they first came out. And now they're icons. Mm-hmm. So it just goes to show you that, you know, maybe it's not the right time for it. I think Audemars Piguet made a bit of a mistake by touting it so much. You know, they were talking about what a great breakthrough piece it was and things like that. And then you look at it and it's a watch. You know, it's nothing breakthrough, really. But, mm-hmm. you know, time will tell. And I think that's the sort of standpoint that we as journalists have to take. We can report on the controversy, but I think we have no business reporting on what we feel. You know, my job, I think, as a journalist is to present the watch, say the specifics and details of the watch, and then let the reader make a decision. Mm-hmm. It's not up to me to make a decision.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Then it's not also our role to kind of convince people to go in either direction, either good or bad.
Yes, exactly. I think we present the information. And I often don't think it's our position to say whether we like it or not, you know, because that's maybe an undue influence. I think we just present it and see what people think.
The thing that was funny to watch also is all the kind of like the memes that came out on social media about AP and the watch itself. I think it's very telling of you know, the times and how people use social media and the internet to kind of voice their opinion.
Well, there's so much vitriol out there.
Yeah,
people. But my favorite meme was the one with François Benhamias holding somebody's head like in Bird Box, saying, "Look, look, it's beautiful." I thought that was the greatest meme.
Yeah, there was one also as Homer Simpson, who was just slowly hiding behind a bush, just walking backwards, going behind a bush to hide itself from the criticism. But I mean, in the end, you know, like AP is such a strong brand, and that's probably not gonna hurt them in any way. I mean, they still have other collection that and lines that's gonna keep selling. And I mean, it's good also for people to kind of experiment certain ways and see what can and cannot work in certain generations.
Well, I think AP has been trying for quite a while to come up with another icon like the Royal Oak. They thought the millenary was going to be it, and it really didn't turn into it. So, you know, you got to credit them for trying to develop something else. Yeah. Whether it'll happen or not, only time will tell, really.
Okay, so for all the editor-in-chiefs, you guys picked out watches that you thought were the top ones in certain categories. And I think for your theme, it was for the athlete.
Yes.
Why did you choose this category?
Well, I'm quite a sporty guy, so I'm a runner and a martial artist and a tennis player and I ride a motorcycle and do some biking. So I really feel comfortable in the sports watch category. So that's why I chose that. And this year it was a bit challenging because there weren't that many sports watches introduced. I mean, SIHH isn't normally a sports watch kind of show. Basel is much more sports watch oriented.
Right.
But this year I was able to find find three examples that I thought were really good. And the first one that I thought was really spectacular, not just the watches, but the way they were presented, was were the watches from Panerai, because they debuted the submersible as its own collection. And the three key pieces that they introduced were paired with experiences that you couldn't otherwise buy. So the one that I featured in the magazine was the Mike Horn Expedition submersible, where if you buy this limited edition piece, it was limited to 19 pieces. If you bought it, included in the price was this experience with Mike Horn in the ice floes of the Arctic. And that's not something you could just call up Mike Horn and say, "Hey, I want to come with you to the ice floes." He'd tell you to take a long walk on a short pier. So, to be able to get that sort of an experience at the same time you buy a watch. Now, sure, there are only 19 available in each of those three. There are only 19 available, so the number of people that will be able to do that is very limited, and most people won't have that chance. But it's really something cool to get people talking, I think.
We actually met Mike Horn in Hong Kong when he made a short
Yeah, he made a stop
stopover.
here, yeah.
He's a really cool guy.
Yeah, he is. He lives in
Yeah.
Switzerland. He's kind of bounced around from brand to brand, but it's nice that he's working with Ben right now.
Yeah, the thing is, it's interesting because we're actually on his boat and we were having a chat with him where he really wanted to have a watch that was paired with an experience with him to go somewhere. So his take was that the customer would actually have to earn the watch by going on an expedition with him and then
First,
complete, yeah, first, and then complete some kind of challenges, and then he would be able to buy the watch.
Oh,
I
that's a
guess
good
what
idea.
they did it the other way, which the client has to buy it first and then I guess go on the expedition. But it's still good that this idea was able to become concrete in the end.
I think we'll see more of that sort of thing because I think luxury is evolving into something that is experiential based, especially as more purchases move to the internet. And it becomes a kind of transaction. I think brands have to try to find a way to stand out. And this is certainly one of the ways. And everybody's been talking about these experiences, so it's worked for Panerai.
Yeah, for sure. Do you think that's also a very good step as the for the new CEO to kind of make his mark, at Panerai?
Yes, I think Jean-Marc, who was at Roger Dubuis before, and I got to know him pretty well, he's a smart guy. And he had done not so much experiences with Roger Dubuis, but they'd done partnerships with lifestyle brands like Lamborghini and some others, Pirelli.
Yeah.
So he's always been aware that they have to offer more than just the watch. And I think with Panerai, they've taken it to the next level.
Okay, and the other watches that you've chosen.
So the second watch that I chose was the Gerard Perregaux Laureato Absolute Chronograph. The chronograph is one of my favorite complications in a sports watch because. As an athlete, you like to time whatever it is you're doing, whether it's your bike ride or your run. So it's good to have a chronograph. And I'm a big fan of Laureato because I think it's a very nice looking watch. And this put everything together. It was in a titanium case, which was light. It's water resistant to 300 meters, has a rubber strap, and it has this chronograph. So that was a really nice watch. And the third piece was from Ressence. It was one of the problems with dive watches is as soon as they get underwater, they reflect the light, and the surface can often be a mirror when you go to check the time or check how much time
Right. For
remaining.
all kinds of diver watches.
Yes, it's called, I'm trying to remember what it's called.
Is it light refraction?
It's called total eternal reflection. So it turns the crystal into a mirror. And often you have to move your wrist around to find the right angle to see the watch. But with Ressence, because there's oil filled in the upper chamber where the dial is, There's none of that reflection. So to have a watch like that, that you can take underwater was really something special.
Yeah, and then I think they came out this year, they had an update where they came out of actually a white dial, I think to the Type 5, their diver's watch.
Yes, that's right. So, the Type 5, I think, is really cool. And the fact that it has that the bezel is integrated into the case and there's no crown really makes it a nice watch. You know, you don't have to worry about it catching on anything when you're diving or even snorkeling or swimming. So I think it was really a nice piece.
Yeah, for sure. At the same time, from Raisance, last year they had this prototype of the Type 2, and this year was the production model that they released, which is the one where, so it's basically, it just lives by itself. Like you don't need anything to wind it. It's always kind of wound up with this small mechanism that they have inside, which is powered by batteries.
The e-crown.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I think Raisance is really doing some interesting things.
Yeah, so I guess we can finish this small little chat with some predictions for Basel, if you have any, or if there's, did you hear anything maybe before?
Well, I think that this is going to be one of the most interesting Basels in recent memory, I think, because so many brands have left, and you can't even find an exhibitor list on the Basel website yet. So, you know, when I'm trying to make appointments with Basel brands, I really don't know who's exhibiting anymore. I talked to Farver Luba yesterday and I said, oh, can we make a Basel appointment? And they were like, oh, we're not a Basel this year. Like I could have done that, you know? So I think it'll be interesting to see how they move things around. I've heard that the atelier where the independents are has been moved to the press area where the press room used to be. But I've also heard that it's in the Movado area, which is on the same side of the street, but it's not the same building. So I'm not sure where everything is. So it'll be a nice challenge to try to figure out where things are. And, you know, with the Swatch Group gone, that whole area, I think, has been turned into some sort of media area. So I think that will be interesting to see whether that's going to be something that's worthwhile. Quite honestly, I didn't think the press areas at SIHH were particularly valuable. I'm not a blogger. So I think it's more for the blogger and social media guys than for journalists like the Revolution guys. But it'll be interesting to see what they can offer. And I'm hoping that the trend of introducing really interesting models will continue in Basel. I think most brands realize they can't just come out with Me Too kind of watches anymore. They won't get any sales and they won't get any notice. So I'm hoping that that they picked up the mantle and are really going to come out with something cool.
Okay. Are there any particular brands that you're interested to see?
I think that Bulgari is one of my favorite brands anyway, because I just love the Octo and I love what they do with the Finissimo. And I saw them in SIHH because they did a little bit of a pre-Basel during that week. Right. So got a sneak peek of that. But I think they're going to come out with some spectacular pieces again this year at Basel. So I'm really looking forward to seeing Bulgari. And I'm fascinated on the other end of the spectrum. I'm fascinated with Gucci because Gucci is just such a force in fashion right now. They're just so successful. And it'll be interesting to see if they're going to take watches to another level, because they've, for a while before this new guy, Alexander Michele, came in as the designer, they were kind of playing with automatic movements and doing some more interesting watches. And then it all went fashion, with the bees and these supposed icons of Gucci. Mm-hmm. But I heard some rumblings that maybe Gucci is going to do some more interesting watches this year. So I'm hoping that that's one of the things that that will turn heads.
Mm-hmm. I mean, quite a lot of the fashion brands have been making more interesting watches of late, like Hermes. The watches were quite cool. Chanel as well. They're really up their watchmaking game.
Yeah, it's funny because Gucci, if you remember, with Severin Wonderman, they really started the fashion watch sector by just doing these low-cost entry-level timepieces. And then that changed, as you said, with Hermes and Chanel. They brought out some sort of high complications or interesting other kind of complications. And Gucci never really went that direction. And now they're even more into fashion. But I'm hoping that they'll come out with something interesting. I'm always fascinated by the power that a designer has in fashion. And this guy, Alessandro Michela, he can just say something and it gets done. And I really love that. I think it's scary. And I don't know how long it'll last for this guy. But I think it's really cool when somebody, you know, because so much of what we do is by committee. Like, we talk about something, we say, well, we like this or we don't like that. Or, and a lot of the watches are designed by committee. But in Gucci and some of these fashion houses, one guy decides, or one guy or one girl decides. They say, this is the way it goes. And somebody says, well, what about this? And they'll go, no, this is it. And I think that's really bold and really, really something special. And I'm hoping it translates into some really cool watches.
Okay, cool. It was really great talking to you, Keith.
Yeah, nice
Thank
to
you
talk
so
to you
much.
Too. It was a pleasure. And anytime you want to do it, I'm happy to do it.
All right, great.
Awesome. We'll make sure to get you on the pod again.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, then.
Thank you.
All right, so that was Keith calling us, editor-in-chief of Revolution USA. I just want to quickly jump back on something that we mentioned with him in the chat. So I briefly talked about the Raisons Type 2, which is the new watch from the brand, but I feel like I didn't properly explain what the watch was about. So the Type 2 basically started as a like a prototype at SIHH 2018, right? Once they presented, they kind of went silent and they didn't give out any new information about the watch until SIHH 2019. And so SIHH 2019, you see now like a proper production version of the watch itself. And so first of all, it's like it's a proper Raisons, right? It's like if you've seen Raisons watches before, it's going to be the same. So it's the same kind of mechanics inside with their patented Raisons orbital convex system. And so it's a mechanical movement. It's kind of separated into two chambers, and you have magnets inside that allows you to kind of move the movement and control the different dials that move around the dial. Because it's basically one big dial, and then you have like smaller ones, and then they all move together in unison. And then so with the Type 2, you have a module on top of that, which is called the E-Crown. And so the E-Crown, so you don't say it's a quartz movement, because it's not a quartz watch, like it's really a mechanical watch with some kind of digital, module on it, okay? And so the E-Crown basically allows the watch to remember the time of the watch and keep track of it. So basically, if you were to put down the watch at some point and the energy would kind of wind down, by waking up the watch and tapping on a crystal, the E-Crown module would reset the watch to the correct time. So you just have to imagine like how crazy it is that you basically have a mechanical watch that you can just tap and it would adjust the time just basically by itself. It's like almost magical when you look at all the videos on it. Obviously, you have an app that goes with it, so you can set up different time zones and you can switch between all the different functions, but you can also switch between the functions just by tapping on a watch. So you have like a small indicator on the watch, you tap it, changes the different functions and the time zones and all that stuff.
But if you don't want to use the E-Crown function, the watch functions as a normal mechanical watch.
Yeah, you actually have the option to turn off the E-Crown altogether and just have like a, you know, just use your watch as a typical like normal mechanical watch, which I think is cool. You know, it just gives the option for the wearer. And yeah, so I mean, you basically just have to set the watch the first time when you receive it and you take it out the box, because then after you just have that automatic digital system that's in perpetual, always keeping track of the time. And the way it does that is that obviously you have the energy issue, and so that's fixed by so there's some small like kind of almost like solar panel on the E-Crown module that just captures energy and just keeps the battery alive all the time. So I mean, just in itself, like if you have time, just like go read the stories that we have online about this watch, because it's just like awesome, and that's something that I'm sure we'll see more in the future.
So our second guest is Sumit. He's our global online editor. Let's get on the call with him right now.
All right, so joining us next is Sumit Nag, who is the global online editor for Revolution. What's up, Sumit?
All good, sir. I'm back in Switzerland just for a short bit. It's cold as ever, but you know what? It's actually better than what it was in January, so I'm a bit thankful.
All right, so we had Keith Strandberg before on the call, and we asked him how he got into watches and what brought him to Revolution. So we're going to do the same with you. Do you mind telling us how you got into watches?
Sure. I mean, for the bulk of us, I think it was always the little interest aspect of things. For me, it was extremely at the surface level. But obviously, when I reached out to Revolution as the company that I wanted to kind of start things off with to really take my interest to another level, it was the point of also learning how little I actually knew about the entire industry and how basically luxury watchmaking in this day and age carries itself forward. But that was early 2015, mid 2015 is when I joined the company. A short year after I took over taking care of most of our digital channels. And here we are.
Did you have a background in journalism or working in other media?
Absolutely not. I actually, prior to this, I used to work at a digital consultancy. That's a whole other different sort of a world. Basically, I got tired of having to deal with clients mostly. I had enough. Okay, so like the story that I like to tell is that the last time I was in a client meeting at my last job, the thing that really set me off was the client saying this round icon isn't this circle icon isn't round enough. And I was like, okay, sure, yeah, let's take it from there.
Right. Okay. So this is your third SIHH then, or fourth?
This would be my third. You're...
Yeah.
Hey. No, hang on. It's my fourth SIHH. Okay. Yeah.
So how do you feel about it this time, your fourth time? You must be quite a pro at, you know,
navigating all the booths
and when is a good time to have lunch and stuff like that.
Okay, so the thing about SIHH and basically the watch shows and how it plays out for me is that it's my timetable's never really my own. The way that I deal with SIHH is essentially that I follow through with Mr. Waco's schedules, because I'm in charge of basically as the producer of sorts to get content going while we're on the ground with Wei. For the past couple of rounds, it's basically meant that we have a videographer and a photographer in the room, and we're getting a video shot that he's doing as a conversation with the CEO. But prior to that, he's already seen the product, so which means that when we stitch it together in the next couple of hours and have it up on YouTube, it's like this seamless first hands-on with the products on hand. Not products, the watches on hand, while he's speaking to the CEO, discussing what's on the onset for the next year. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I think there's been some good response from all the videos that we've been doing either at Basel and SIHH. The fact that people can, you know, pretty much immediately or very soon after see a video that has kind of like a recap of what the brand is showing.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think the thing is, those videos are never going to be crisp and polished. But we're starting to recognize that, you know what, on the first hand get-go is people just want to be able to look at the new watches and kind of find out from the top minds within that brand what are their motivations from having pushed out those watches at what is probably their biggest fair. For SIHH, that would mean the Richemont brands, along with a few other brands that come into that fair. And Basel is a whole other monster on its own. But yeah, getting word out first with as many sort of visuals on the watch and people behind that watch who created said watch, or what were their mindsets behind creating this piece of watch. That's the sooner you get that out, you know, you feed the monster that is the online community.
I feel like because you're with Wei every step of the way, and he knows the people so well, I feel like you probably get a closer look at what the products are than you know, like me, a typical journalist sitting in a presentation.
Well, I'll tell you this: definitely, you know, the caliber of individual he gets to meet up with. Oftentimes the things that they reveal to the likes of Wei, I would have never thought to ask. I would have never thought to delve into.
Mm. Okay, so of all the things that you've seen, what were some of your favorites? And what brands do you think had strong...
a strong showing.
...showing this year?
Sure. So I suppose if you're asking me on a very personal note, I'd have to go with Cartier. I have absolutely adored what they have been doing in the past year and this year. Mm-hmm. The strength that they've shown in basically bringing back their classic designs in a way that is absolutely relevant to the modern age. Just beautiful watches, right? Because think about it this way: the Santos, the steel Santos that had most people talking this year. Was a watch that was quartz. Does that matter? No, because at the end of the day, it's such a good looking piece of creation that, you know, you're just happy to be wearing that thing. And again, because it is very, as a result of it being quartz, it means that it's actually quite excessively priced considering it's Cartier. And you have to appreciate that from the brand, right?
Yeah.
A few other things I have to say.
Sorry, do you mind that it's only in quartz and they don't have any of the Santos Dumont?
I had this conversation, like I was privy to this conversation last year when Wei was in the room with Carol Forestier, right. And they were looking at the new tank Cintre. And mm-hmm. What happened was like, Wei goes, you know, what movement is in this watch? And then there's a random pause and someone in the room goes, you know what? It actually doesn't matter because it's so good looking. No one's going to ask you what that movement is. And I like thought to myself, you know, that is so true. Sure. Okay. I mean, if it was a whole mechanical movement and whatnot, I guess that's an added advantage of everything that we love about the world of mechanical watches. But there's so much appreciated about the design of and the simplicity and the elegance that Cartier brings through their classical things, you know.
Mm-hmm. But that's very unique to Cartier also, that people don't seem to be bothered about the fact that they have good quartz watches instead of mechanical. Whereas if you would go to maybe another brand, some people might kind of scoff at the fact that they would be showing a quartz watch instead of a mechanical one.
Sure. I mean, I suppose it has to do with the fact that the design aspect for Cartier is such a massive pillar of strength that when they get it right, people don't question what's inside.
I mean, I totally agree. I mean, that Santos Dumont looks like very nice, and the proportions are kind of, you know, just perfect for a lot of people.
Absolutely. The other thing that I have to sort of tip my hat off to is what I call the Davide Cerato effect. I think it's finally come into play for Montblanc, and this year's lineup of watches were absolutely, you know, it speaks to the man and sort of that touch that he brings to his own perception of watch design and what is this this movement of bringing the old into the current age and making it relevant. Case in point, those there was the pulsograph that he did with the salmon dial. And then, but there's also a white dial version of that, both of which are equally gorgeous looking watches. And the only point of difference is the movement that he puts inside. And in fact, there was a multi-scale chronograph that was also part of the lineup. It's like a black dial, but with multiple colored scales. Another thing, I mean, like, you know, to put so much information onto a solitary dial, that actually takes a lot of just balancing things out, right? You got to appreciate how he's brought it all together like that.
Yeah, and I mean, at the Mont Blanc also, they had their update to their perpetual calendar, which is just like the overall feel is just so much better.
It's so different
than the one they had before. Yeah.
and you gotta, yeah, it's really just the subtleties that where he's put his touch into. It's quite the feat. My hat's off to the gentleman. Yeah. And if I were to pick a last one from the lot, I'd have to say that Ceritanium double chronograph from IWC is something to really look at. You know, that entire stealth aspect of that watch, it does something to that known design of the IWC double chronograph. It's something to, like, you have to see it to believe it. It's really beautiful. But I think part of that part of the reason why that watch stuck in my head was because earlier, late in December, when Revolution was up at the Phillips auction in New York alongside the Rake 4, that partnership that we had, and then there was a 3705 that was formerly the property of
Mr. Blumlein, is it?
Mr. Gunther Blumlein. Just that the interest that it created amongst the watch community. I think that's gotten that black ceramic aesthetic sort of fresh in our minds right now. And the fact that, you know, here is IWC saying, look, this is not just ceramic anymore, but we've somehow put ceramic and titanium together in a way that's that's really elevated the technical process that it is. But then through the technicality of it to create this aesthetic that really brings everything together with the stealth dial and the way that the numerals are in this like a dark grayish thing on the black dial itself. It's all visible, but at the same time that stealth feel of it that takes a different sort of mindset to be able to get right.
Right. And so the two watches that you just mentioned, the Montblanc and the IWC, so those were part of the section that you had to write about, the theme kind of roundup that you had, that you were assigned for the magazine. So yours was called The Old Soul. Do you mind explaining a little bit the title?
So don't ask me why I got assigned The Old Soul, but I don't know. Maybe I'm an old soul. So that was sort of the theme that was assigned for me. And as much as I have to say that this year, you know, there weren't as many watches that were out and about in the sense of like, oh, these are all vintage inspired. Because, you know, even with the Montblanc, as much as I want to say that that's vintage inspired, like you can see a lot of vintage in there, but you can't say that this is a recreation of this specific watch. And that is what is, again, sort of an elevation of what Davide managed to do, is that you can see a lot of elements of vintage there, but you can't say that he copied the past. And again, hats off to the gentleman, right? But you know, the one that stuck in the mind, if we were to talk about a watch that's been brought back from the past, it would have to be that Audemars Piguet Royal Oak extra thin jumbo with the salmon dial, right? Because that's essentially a recreation of the 1992 20th anniversary
the Jubilee,
watch. Yeah.
That one was in white gold.
That one, no, that
no,
that
sorry,
one
that was
in
steel.
Steel.
This one
is in white gold. The difference is being that in the 1992 version had gold rivets on the bezel. This one has rivets that completely blend into the watch, into the rest of the watch. And I think the other sort of thing that they did to blend the watch together is that the date wheel, the date disc now, is of the same color as the dial. Right. So very subtle little things that really elevate the watch, I suppose. And again, it's such a point of simplicity, but it just is so beautiful.
Just before you move on, because that one had also a little bit kind of like a controversy surrounding it. So at first it was announced that it was just limited to 75 examples, is it? And then after the position kind of switched to a 75 pieces annually. And then do you know finally what it is now? Is it annually or is it not limited at all?
So the last thing that was shared with us pertaining to this watch is that it's not going to be limited by number, but they are going to have a limited production of these. They're not going to continue to create them for years on end, that's for sure. But again, I mean, look, they kept that original 39 millimeter dimension. And funnily enough, it's the same 21-21 movement that was in the 1992 piece. Just all of that coming together to give us this classic in a re-edition of sorts. I don't know. Sometimes simple is the best way to go, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you can see the reaction the overall community had. Like, everyone went crazy for it.
Yeah, yeah, considering they had something else to really shout about at the fair. Yeah. Well, no, let's not get chuckly about it. But it's true. They went with intention, having spent a fair bit of effort developing something. 8 years was it in development and research, and finally coming to what was the 1159. You know, the thing about it is, you're gonna a brand, a company, a setup is gonna have their time in creating the things that they want to bring to the next level for the company itself. Because let's think about it this way: that AP, yes, we know AP for the Royal Oak, but then they've had the Millinery, and what was the other? I don't even remember.
The Jules Audemars.
The Jules Audemars, exactly.
Yeah.
Those are other lines that they've had in their collection for a while now. But you know, I suppose it's just that the fanatic watch collecting community has such a strong connection with AP and the Royal Oak through AP.
Yeah, for sure.
That it's difficult for them to identify anything else as AP right now, if I may suggest that. And it's really one of the underlying reasons why, when they saw something so different come out from the brand, that the reaction was as such.
So do you think that maybe they went a bit too strong on it to kind of make a switch, and they should have maybe introduced it at a slower pace?
I don't know if slower is the answer here. I do think that they had the likes of a brand like AP is going to do their homework before they go ahead to do what they do, right? Which means to say that they've calculated everything, or at least I'm assuming here that, you know, the due homework was done before anything was pressed, the go button was pressed. And unfortunately, when you bring something fresh to public light, you can never predict fully how it's going to be taken, right? Therein, you know, it was a gamble of sorts. And then, as much as I want to say that we are hearing the naysayers out loud, there's probably a good handful of people who are just as much in favor of what they've created with 1159. So maybe we're just hearing the haters a little louder
They're a bit louder. Yeah. Is there any other brands that you feel like you want to mention?
Okay. So maybe the two big super complications, right? That we saw at the fair. It's difficult to talk about SIH 2019 without mentioning those two watches, because you have to give credit to those two grand maisons for pushing boundaries as they have, because let's consider Vacheron Constantin this time around. They kept their entire SIH just extremely compact. They had actually, you can count within your 10 fingers, but that's just them saying that, you know, we are keeping on track, but look, we are innovating at the same time. And they showed innovation at a very high level with a twin beat. The fact that this is such, when you think about it, it's actually a very practical solution. But to come up with the mechanism in the elegant way that they've managed to is, it takes the likes of a watchmaker such as Vacheron Constantin to come up with that. And of course, the other one to mention is Jaeger. And with Jaeger, again, with this, what we've otherwise known to be this massive tourbillon complication, how they've managed to kind of really shrink this entire thing down almost, right? So that it's now contained within this extremely wearable timepiece. You know, that just goes to show that these are watchmakers who are true to their craft and never too eager to rest on their laurels. So they're constantly bettering themselves like these, and therefore when they get it spot on like this, and they don't even need to talk about it, they don't even need to shout about it, they leave it out there for the world to see and shout for on behalf of the Maisons. And I think that's exactly what happened with those two super complicated watches.
All right, well, Sumit, thank you very much for taking the time to call us in. It was a pleasure speaking to you, and then we'll talk to you very soon.
Absolutely, thanks guys.
All right, see ya.
Okay, all right, that was Sumit, our global online editor. Great talking with him, as always.
Yeah, both of them, Keith and Sumit, had great insights on the fair. And before we wrap up the show, should we mention a little bit of like Basel Talk, or there's anything that you've seen or some of the brands have, advertised? If you look at Instagram, it's mostly Rolex who's been kind of teasing their own stuff.
Which is unusual, right? Do they usually...
I don't think I've seen them do that before. I can't see. Because like they're really... Like it's like, what, 12 posts in a row?
Yeah, it's like so obvious.
Where it's just the male Gauss. So you already know that there's going to be a new male Gauss.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think usually Rolex is very... They don't promote it as much, right? You just like usually play kind of the guessing game. And then once you arrive at the show on the first day... Everyone go crazy, like, oh my god, they released this and this and this.
But what are the other guesses, apart from the male Gauss?
Well, the thing is that maybe they're like promoting and putting all the efforts on the male Gauss so that people don't try to like guess and focus the other collections, right? Because like some of our colleagues from other websites online have tried to play the game, the guessing game. Some of them come up with a new thinner Submariner with a matte dial. Some of them have come up with, so last year it was the Pepsi GMT with a steel case and on the Jubilee bracelet. So people are saying, oh, this year it might be the Coke coming in that configuration as well. So, there's no, obviously apart from the male Gauss, there's no clue on the other collections from Rolex.
So I hope you enjoyed this episode, and we will see you very soon.
If you like this podcast, please subscribe and rate us 5 stars on whichever platform you get your podcast, and we'll hope you tune in for the next episode. Bye.
Bye.